Thank you so much for having me here. I did this 2 years ago, and it was one of the best forums for candidates that I've seen, and I hope to reproduce that tonight, have a really interesting, entertaining forum. I'm going to explain the rules and the background and what we're going to do tonight. All nine candidates on the ballot are expected to participate. We're just waiting for one more. The seating arrangement was decided by lottery. And audience members, you should have note cards so that you can write down questions, and we'll be using those at the latter half of the program. And they will be picked up by volunteers through the evening. So if you have a question and you write it down, if you just raise your hand and wave your card, somebody will come around and pick it up. Responses from the candidates tonight will be timed. Candidates, timed, okay? And signs will be held up to signal speakers of their remaining time. We have the green card down front right here. Carol, green card. And then there it is, yellow card. That means 30 seconds left, and red card for stop. And verbal interaction between the audience and the candidates during the forum will not be permitted. I have been watching the presidential debates. I have been taking notes. I promise you, I am way better than they are. So we will not be tolerating some of the behavior that we have seen from our presidential environment. However, we do invite you to stay and chat with the candidates for a few minutes after the forum is over. Perhaps ask them any questions that you feel weren't asked during the forum. And after I introduce each candidate, they will each be given a two-minute opening statement. And then I'm going to present the candidates with a scenario that they were given ahead of time, and they will explain how they would handle that situation, and they'll have 2 minutes each to do that as well. And then following this section, and this is my favorite part, we're going to do a lightning round, which I think is super cool, where candidates will give quick visual indications of their answers to a set of questions. Sort of like thumbs up or down, raise your hand. And I just think that's great because we can get through several questions and issues pretty quickly. And then with the remainder of the time, that's when we'll do the audience questions. Two candidates will be chosen to answer each question asked with 1 minute for each response. And at the finale of the event, each candidate will have the opportunity for a 30-second closing statement. So that'll go really quickly. And any questions from the candidates? You guys are good? Thumbs up? Okay. All right, so I'm going to introduce each candidate individually, and they will have 2 minutes for an opening statement before we move to the next candidate. And we will proceed in the order drawn by the candidates before the event. And as a reminder, you each have 2 minutes. You'll get a 30-second remaining time, and then a red when your time is up and a beep. Please finish up your sentence. Otherwise, I go into moderator mode, and you really don't want to see that. So just finish your thought, move on. All right, let's start with the first speaker of the evening. Phil Kim began his career in education, teaching seventh-grade life science, and now works as an innovation manager, advising schools on best practices around personalized and blended learning. He has worked at the school, regional, state, and national levels on science education. And more information may be found at philkim.org. Phil, 2 minutes.
Hello, thank you so much for having us here today. It is a pleasure to be here and always wonderful to be able to speak and listen to families. I did begin my time in education teaching seventh grade life science, and I stayed in education because I fell in love with teaching and my students and the relationships that I could build with the family members and the community that was just so welcoming and amazing. You know, there's not much that we know about K-12 education, quite honestly. We can go back and forth about how blended learning works or whether or not technology is right for kids. There's really not much that we can confirm or deny is actually effective in moving student outcomes in our classrooms or in our schools, period. But what we do know is that high quality teaching coupled with high quality resources results in better student outcomes. That is one thing that we do know for sure and for certain. And I am so shocked and surprised that our current board doesn't have a single licensed credentialed educator on it. And while I greatly respect and admire the policies and the rather progressive work that our board has done, in my opinion, what I can contribute to our board and the work that we have done in laying a solid foundation of policy is to actually bring a perspective of what it means to take those programs and put them into the classroom and see those out. I am very proud of the work that I have done as an educator, specifically around science curriculum. That is kind of my background. I studied neuroscience as an undergraduate student, and I find deep passion in implementation of the next generation science standards and project-based learning. And of course, in my current background is personalized learning and figuring out how technology can best improve student outcomes by augmenting the work of teachers in the classroom. Additionally, as a first-generation American student who grew up with parents who financially struggled, that, you know, education is a very personal thing to me, and I will talk more about that later.
Good job. Okay, thank you. Next up, we have Trevor McNeil. He's a third-generation teacher and native San Franciscan with experience as an SFUSD substitute and paraprofessional. Aside from full-time teaching, Trevor currently serves on the board of the Intersensat Neighborhood Association, the city's Pedestrian Safety Advisory Committee, and the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee. Trevor, 2 minutes.
Thank you again for being here tonight. Yes, I am the only public school teacher on the ballot this fall. And that's one of the major reasons I'm running. We haven't elected a teacher to the school board in 12 years. And I think that perspective is important because, one, you know, we all care about education, but I walk the walk. I'm in the classroom with my seventh graders every day dealing with the budget constraints, dealing with new policy, dealing with maybe boards that have a great concept but haven't been in the classroom enough to actually see it implemented. So that's going to inform a lot of the things that I want to work on in my first few years as a school board commissioner. I want to work on fixing the substitute assignment system. I want to work on teacher recruitment and retention. Absolutely, it's about money. I'm a public school teacher raising my daughter in a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco. It ain't easy. But there's a lot of other things that I want to bring to the table about the best way to recruit and retain and create a sort of professional learning community for teachers. The other reason I'm running is I'm a parent. I've got a daughter running around in the foyer or whatever. And I really do care about the community that she lives in. It breaks my heart that already, she's 16 months old, that already friends of ours from like our birthing class and people like that are already calling having a kid in San Francisco the 6-year countdown because they start itching to go to some suburban school because they hear these rumors about our schools that simply aren't true. And so dispelling those rumors, really investing in a concerted PR effort is going to be something that I think actually is going to be important. We've seen a lot of improvement over the schools recently, and it's because we've had families come back from during the Great Recession. I want to build new schools. If we're building new housing in the city, in Park Merced, and Treasure Island, and Mission Bay, we need to be building new schools. I want to be always thinking about an ideal future while we also take care of our current students. So those are the very personal reasons I'm running for the Board of Education. So thank you very much.
Perfect timing. Thank you. Next up, we have Rachel Norton. She has served on the Board of Education since January 2009, and previously she served as a site council co-chair and a member of the District Special Education Advisory Committee. Her daughters have attended McKinley Elementary School, Argonne Elementary School, Roosevelt Middle School, and currently attend George Washington High School. Rachel, 2 minutes.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Oh, yeah. Good evening, everyone, and thank you to the families and the faculty of the Ruth Asawa School of the Arts for hosting us this evening. As Jill said, I'm Rachel Norton. I have been on the board for 2 terms. I'm currently running for a 3rd term. I'm a parent of 2 students in the district, and it's through being a parent involved in our schools that I came to this work. My older daughter has a disability, and it was in advocating for her that I saw that we had some serious problems in our special education programs. Not so much experience like families like mine, because I am a good advocate for my child and I was able to get her the services most of the time that she needed. But there are a lot of families out there that have kids with disabilities that are not being served as appropriately as they should be. And that was why I originally ran for the Board of Education. One of the things that I'm extremely proud of that I've accomplished on the board with the help of the staff and the leadership of the senior staff and the former superintendent is that we now have a fully inclusive school district, and every school fully includes students with disabilities, which was not the case 8 years ago when I first ran, and I'm extremely proud of that. We still have a ways to go in a lot of things in special education, but being an inclusive school district is a huge first step. I have also done a lot of work on the board in the area of student assignment. I remain interested in working with families and working with the staff to really improve our outcomes there and desegregate schools and support enrollments at schools that are really struggling. And of course, I'm very interested now. We need to find a new superintendent, and I'm very energized about that search and excited about having a conversation with the community about what kind of leadership do we want in our next superintendent. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. Next up, we have Stevan Cook, and he's a third-generation San Franciscan. Stevan's success as an academic advisor at Marshall led to his appointment to the Community Advisory Committee to the Public Education Enrichment Fund. In March of 2015, Stevan accepted a position as CEO of Mission BIT, a nonprofit focused on expanding computer science education to public school students. Stevan, 2 minutes.
Good evening, and I apologize for being a few minutes late. I was coming from Mission BIT. We're in the middle of a bunch of hiring, so I was working on that. I also want to just give a kudos to the organizers of this forum in 2014 when Shimon and Emily, I know you were both there. The Giants were in the World Series, right? And there were like three people there. So, you know, you've grown your forum. And in that race, I came within 1% of winning. So thank all of you that voted for me in 2014. You know, we're close to the election this time around again. I have some history connected to this school, and I talk about the reasons that I'm running. I know I have a time limit. My father was the first graduating class of McAteer. And when I was in high school, when McAteer was closed, the students from McAteer came to Thurgood Marshall, where I graduated from school. My entire experience in public education has been from the perspective of someone that truly needs this district in order to be able to be in a position to interrupt generational poverty, to have an opportunity to go to college. We have a school system that is facing a lot of systemic issues where the access to achievement is very different depending on what family you come from, what school you go to. Those systemic issues drove me to run for Board of Education initially, and they are why I continue to do work that I do in public schools. Currently at Mission BIT, we're expanding computer science education across San Francisco. You know, those are the types of very common sense, basic things that we want more of our young people to be associated with so they can have opportunities to actually be able to afford to live in the city. And a lot of those systemic issues that I hope I can get into a bit more deeply are the reasons why I'm running for office. Thank you.
Thank you, Stevan. All right, up next we have Rob Geller. He is a 30-year Mission resident, has 2 children in SFUSD schools, including a daughter at Lowell High School. He is in public health finance with the city, is chair of the James Lick Middle School Site Council, a neighborhood activist, organic community gardener, musician, SEIU 1021 bargaining team nominee, and SF Youth Works mentor. Rob, 2 minutes.
Good evening, everybody, and thanks for the... Thanks to the parents for public schools for having us. I am a parent in the public schools. I'm not a CEO, but I am a DAD. I have, as they say, skin in the game. I have 2 children in the district, as she said, one up at Lowell High School and one at James Lick Middle School. I know the schools because I'm living them every day. I don't have to tell you what it's like to be a public school parent, to live your child's ever-quickening semesters alongside them, going to parent-teacher conferences, back to school night, driving them to school, drama productions, orchestra concerts, debate clubs, besides them every single day, working through changes, crises, celebrations, tears, joy, laughs, and pages of homework too numerous to recount. Not to mention just finding the right school and making sure that the kids have enough sleep and enough to eat. You know what it's like to be a parent, and I respect everybody on here who's running for office, but until you really share the day-to-day school life with your child and really lived it, you can't know what it's like to be a family in this district. You can't really feel our pain. I am the only challenger who's running who actually has children in the district. Many of us are working families who are trying to earn a living wage in the most expensive city in America, trying to just working hard, paying taxes, and we can't afford private school. We need our public schools to be excellent. That's why we get upset when the current board, in the name of equity, in a false sense of equity, cuts things like eighth grade algebra and honors and the GATE program, valued opportunities that benefit every single family, regardless of your race or socioeconomic status. Equity is supposed to be about bringing everybody up, not bringing some people down. That's no way to close an achievement gap. So one of the reasons I'm running is to try to make more sense of equity in our district. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Next up, we have Mark Sanchez, who has 20-plus years experience as a teacher, 8 years on the San Francisco Board of Education, and is a public school principal. As the co-founder of Teachers for Social Justice, Mark has worked to create quality schools for all of our children to give stronger voice to parents and educators. Mark was one of the authors of the 2004 Prop H, or PEEF, that was resoundingly passed and renewed by the voters in 2015. Mark, 2 minutes.
Works. Hi, everybody. Thank you, School of the Arts, for hosting, opening your doors for this forum, and Parents for Public Schools for organizing this event. I'm really happy to be here. Currently, I am principal at Cleveland Elementary School in the Excelsior District. It's my sixth year. Very proud to be a principal at that school and to work with the kids. I have 365 students at that school, and I work hard every day to make sure that they get what they need. Unfortunately, as we've seen throughout the district over the years, over the decades, our schools are extremely segregated. My school is 85% Latino in a district that's not 85% Latino. 95% students of poverty. When I taught in this district in the 90s, I taught at Glen Park Elementary School, Edison Elementary School before it was a charter school, and then Paul Revere Elementary School. All schools that were in middle class neighborhoods, mostly white neighborhoods, but no white kids going to those schools. So we have a historic issue around segregation, hyper-segregation, I would call it. And even though I think we've done a lot of things to try to mitigate that, we've never really gotten to where we need to be to make sure that when you walk into a classroom, you'll actually see black and white kids in the same classrooms. And I think that that's something that we all need to be committed to making sure happens in the future. I don't know if anybody has that the answer to make sure that happens, but I think we need to have the will to make sure that all students get what they need in our district. When I served on the Board of Education, the last 2 years I was president of the Board of Ed, and I led the hiring, and Jill Wins actually led the recruitment of Carlos Garcia. I think one of the best superintendents this district has ever seen, ever had, I think in the whole country, actually. And I think that if I'm able to get back onto the school board, I would like to help this board make sure we hire the absolute best superintendent that we can find. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. And next we have Ian Kalin. He's a parent, U.S. Navy veteran, and a President Obama appointee. He has successfully managed billion-dollar budgets and led thousands of people. Locally, he helped SFUSD to raise funds and improve family services. Kalin is using this experience to fight for every kid in San Francisco. Ian, 2 minutes.
Thanks. Hello, everyone. My name's Ian Kalin. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about our schools. I believe too many of San Francisco's kids are not getting the education they deserve. I believe this because of my own experience with my two kids, started with my son, now 3 and a half, looking across the street and asking that classic new parent question, is that school going to be good or bad for my son? That's how this started. And the frustration I felt with the impossibility of answering that question led me to work directly for the district. I've helped them raise money for years. I've helped them to modernize their technology systems, something I continue doing today, and helping a lot of the administrators to even connect with parents and teachers and the workers throughout the entire system. And what I learned in that experience, frankly, terrified me, and is the focus behind my three big issues of, on a policy sense, what I'm fighting for. Number one, budgets. We're broke. And I think everyone up here agrees on that diagnosis. Where we disagree is the treatment. And I think that I can offer a very new set of ideas, data-driven ideas, for how to really move new money into our schools and not just be talking about this as we have for too long. I mean, just for the folks here, I'm going to take a guess and say, how many of you here, and this, you're not allowed to answer the question, that would break the rules. So mentally, or maybe by a show of hands, which is not verbal, how many of you feel we are investing as much as we should in arts education in San Francisco? Okay, that's what I thought, right? So why not? With all the great folks here, and not just the fantastic public servants, like at least two school board commissioners, I see one deputy superintendent, and I can't really see very much without the lights, but just... when I was talking to the folks outside, your parents, your teachers, we have extraordinary potential in this city to have the best public education in the country. And from an investment perspective, we used to be at the top. But on some level, this potential has not been closed. We have not been able to connect enough of the communities and invest particularly in arts education like we should. The other two big issues with the time that remains is basic accountability and data-driven metrics. Oh, and the last one is neighborhoods, but I hope to talk about that more later. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right, next we have Matt Haney. He is a commissioner on the San Francisco Board of Education, and Matt is also the director of policy at Rebuild the Dream, where he leads policy advocacy for #Cut50, a bipartisan initiative to cut the prison population in half in 10 years, and #YesWeCode, an initiative to create a pipeline for low-opportunity youth to become the best coders, computer engineers, and designers in the world. Matt, 2 minutes.
We love hashtags.
They're right here on the paper.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. Thank you to the organizations that are hosting. Special thank you to the Ruth Asawa School of the Arts community, who I know are well represented here. I've only been in this room, actually, on the other side of this stage, and really watched some extraordinary performances that I think represent the best of what public education can and should be in our city. This is a school where young people feel supported, where they can be themselves, where they're creative, where they fulfill their potential. And I think that's the vision for education that I think that we have and we should have for all of our kids in San Francisco. We have everything that it takes in the city of San Francisco to make that possible. We have the resources. We have the support for public education, as evidenced in this room. But unfortunately, we don't have that in all of our schools right now. That's why I ran 4 years ago, and that's why I'm signing up again to hopefully continue my service on the Board of Education. I think our school district is moving in the right direction. We are seeing our students and our schools moving closer to the sorts of educational experiences that they all need, but we have a long way to go. Our graduation rate this year was higher than it's ever been for all subgroups. That's a great thing. That's very positive. But what are the skills, experiences that all of our kids need to actually thrive in San Francisco in the future? That's the question that we need to start asking, and we need to start making sure that all of our schools reflect that reality. I've worked to make sure that our kids, when they walk in our doors, feel safe and supported and have their social, emotional, and physical needs met. I authored the Safe and Supportive Schools Resolution, which over the last 5 years helped to cut school suspensions by 50% in our district, and we're seeing much more positive school environments. But we also need to make sure that we're investing in the arts, computer science, and have a situation where our teachers can live here and thrive here as well. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. All right, and now we have Jill Wins, who has dedicated her adult life to advocating for and supporting children and public education. And she's been on the San Francisco Board of Education for 24 years, was president of the California School Boards Association, and led efforts that have raised over $3 billion for San Francisco schools. Jill, 2 minutes.
Thank you. And that's the beginning of my campaign speech. But and I want to thank you all for being here tonight and thank the organizers in particular and tell you how happy I am to be here with you. I came to the Board of Education 24 years ago as an advocate for parents in the school district. I was a parent in the school district. Oh, I had been then for maybe 10 years, and I was a public school parent in San Francisco for 22 years, including 3 years as a guardian of a student at this school. And I came to the board on a platform of the district needing to invest in infrastructure to support parents, that we needed infrastructure at the district level. Mm-hmm. It took us a while to get there, actually. I was the author of the resolution that created the Parents Advisory Council, which I'm very proud of the work that they're doing. I was also instrumental in getting the Student Advisory Council up and running after it had been not in existence for a number of years when I was first on the board. While I've been on the board, as you heard, I've actually made my focus school funding because the more I learned about it, the more it was clear to me that we simply do not spend enough money on public education in California. And so I've worked at the state level, at the federal level, very hard. You heard about my being president of CSBA and other organizations in which I've participated. But also we worked hard to make sure that we raised money locally for schools because we were not going to wait around for someone else to do it. So while I've been on the board, I've been the champion of many things, including arts education, healthy food in schools, school health programs, opposing privatization, opposing the commercialization of our schools, and a lot of things that parents, students, and members of the community really value as being improvements in our school. I'm proud of the work we've done, but we have a lot more work to do. So I'm looking forward to the conversation this evening. Thank you.
Thank you. So that ends our first round. I want to remind everyone that there were question cards available out front. If you have those filled out already, just wave them and we'll have somebody come around and collect them. If you need some more paper, they're passing those out. The next round, each candidate was sent the following scenario yesterday and asked to be prepared to respond how they would handle the situation presented to them as a school board member. And again, they will each have 2 minutes to respond in a random order. So Carol, we're 2 minutes again on this one. And we're going to start with Jill Wins. 2 minutes. Oh, wait, let me read the question. That would help, huh? Time's up. Ding.
Thank you.
Okay, here is the scenario. Not every board member or candidate is an expert in every area they have to make decisions in. If you were elected and were presented with a policy about which you have little to no knowledge, how do you go about making a decision? And we will start with Jill.
Okay, thank you. The first thing that you do is that that's one of the main reasons that we have staff. So it's important to trust and know the staff and their areas of expertise. And also, so you need to have relationships with staff, but you need to look at the recommendations or the questions that are posed to the board. What should we do about this? Here's our ideas. Here's the data or the reason that we're proposing this. Also, I think it's really important to do your homework. Really, really important. It's important to do research. It's important to consult with people. It's important to either know with whom you should consult or to ask, to say to staff, tell us on what you're basing this. What should I be reading about this? Where does this come from? And I think it's very important to consult with the community. So you do that in a variety of ways. One, we have meetings where we invite people to come in, whether they're concerned about it, or we also have the infrastructure that I referred to before. So we have the Parents Advisory Council, people who are organized to give us advice, to respond to our policy proposals, to use their own expertise. There are people in the community. We all have our own kind of constituents and supporters, people with whom we have personal relationships that we can trust their advice in a different way. That doesn't mean we do what they tell us to, but it means that we know when we're listening to them to whom we are listening and what biases they may have. So I think doing your homework is really important, and I think consulting with your colleagues is really important. I really value hearing other people's opinions, both the members of the community, teacher representatives, administrators, people who have expertise, as I said, but also my colleagues who have their own points of view. So that's kind of my way of doing that. I think that the more you know, the better decisions you can make. And so that's why I have dedicated myself to knowing as much as I can, learning as much as I can about these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, same question, Mark Sanchez.
I used to say this on the board when Jill would say something really good like that, what she said. Yeah, I don't know if I'd add much to that. When I was on the board for 8 years, I absolutely depended, and I grew into that role. I didn't know a lot when I got on there. I was a school teacher. I was an expert at being a 4 or 5 teacher. So I learned a lot over the years. But what I did learn is that you have to ensure that you reach out to the stakeholder groups to make sure that their voices are heard. We did that very well, I think, when we hired Carlos Garcia. We had a great process to make sure that we got all the stakeholder groups at the table to make sure we heard what they wanted to have in a new superintendent for San Francisco Unified School District. I also agree that you have to do your homework. You have to understand the issues. You have to go deep. And you have to rely on, there are experts on our school board. You know, Rachel is an expert, I think, on special education. She knows a lot about special education. Jill Wins is an expert on finance. I think that we need to make sure that we tap into each other's expertise and make sure that we're listening to each other as well. And Jill also said, and I agree, that our staff is deep. And they have a lot of understanding. And if they don't have the particular understanding, they will do the research as well. And then we have to be able to take that information and go with it. So the stakeholder groups are kind of obvious. We have the parents, and we have our students, and we have our teachers. We also have administrators. Administrators often aren't actually at the table when we make site administrators, when we make decisions about our schools. So I think that it's something that we all have to be really mindful of as board members to make sure that everybody is reached out to make sure that we make the right decision.
Great, thank you. Next up, Rob.
You know, it's really special being here, by the way, because my brother Lou Geller used to teach here at the Soto Academy. I don't know if any of you knew him, but he taught in our district for many, many years, and he passed away a few years ago of cancer. But this is very special to be here. In all my decisions, I would prioritize what's in the best interest of all families, of you guys. I'm going to ask all of you. One thing I won't do is close my eyes and ears to potentially crucial information about a policy because it doesn't conform to a certain narrow agenda or a corporate agenda or my own preconceived biases. As a commissioner, I would be open to learning and opening my ears to every single stakeholder and shift my worldview as necessary when new information comes into play. In the district's core value meme, the D in SFUSD stands for diversity-driven. I will reach out to a diverse range of communities, experts from all sides, gather as much data and knowledge as possible, read relevant studies and reports, bring everyone to the table, consult everyone, colleagues, staff, teachers, paras, site administrators, other districts, and, of course, my colleagues on the board. Again, as a parent, I will reach out to other parents, very important to me, to solicit their opinions as to what is best for them and our children. My wife is a bilingual classroom teacher. At the end of the day, I'd probably ask her and my kids. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. All right, next up, Rachel.
Well, I would agree very much with what my two colleagues to my left said. You know, when my first meeting on the school board, it got this just astoundingly huge binder that I was supposed to read in, a 36-hour period. And I went to Jill, actually, and I said, Jill, how do you go through this agenda? What do you do? And she showed me how she very methodically goes through the agenda, what she looks for, particularly in some of the facilities resolutions, which I had never seen before. So that was really helpful to me. And then when Shimon Walton got on the board, 6 years later, I guess, 4 years later, I offered to do the same thing with him, to say, you know, Jill taught me how to do this, and it was really helpful, and I'd be happy to show you. And so, you know, I think so that collegiality is really important and having those relationships with colleagues, because I learn something from my colleagues every day. We don't always like each other. We don't always get along, but we really do, I think, put the interests of the students and the education of the students first. And so it's always helpful to do that. The other thing that hasn't been mentioned that I think is really important to mention is professional development for board members. And California School Boards Association has been an incredible resource. You know, Jill was the president of that organization, so I don't want to steal your thunder here. But for me, I went through their new board member training in my first 6 months as a board member. I go to the conference every year. I've been a member of the Delegate Assembly for since 2009. And I've made a lot of friends on school boards across the state. So now there are people that I can consult and say, what have you done when this happens? How do you approach this kind of issue? Because there's 1,000 school districts in California. We all are dealing with similar issues, but in different ways because we have different constituencies. And I have found those relationships to be incredibly helpful to me as I navigate what is a very complex, often work.
Great, thank you. And to remind folks of the question, if you were elected and were presented with a policy about which you have little to no knowledge, how would you go about making a decision? And next up, Trevor.
Thank you. For lots of reasons, I've been spending a lot of the last 2 years going to as many board meetings as possible. And one of the things that I think is very important for us is to always be not only seeking support from staff, but also questioning staff. We have to remember that even though I stand before you as a public school teacher and I've got lots of issues that I'm knowledgeable about and care a lot about, we ultimately are not elected to necessarily be the experts in the room. We're elected to be your voice in the room. And so I think that's something very important. So honestly, if I had an issue that I was looking at, I'd Google it. I'd see what was out there already in terms of research, in terms of work done by the media, and in terms of parent activists and other community leaders. I'd talk to them. I'd talk to them, and then I would go to staff, because I want to hear this, what the staff says, but I also want to always remember why this is an issue, how this actually affects student learning, how this actually affects family experience in our schools. So that would be my first step. But also, you know, you do have to go back to the community as well. I think one of the things that happens in my perspective, when I go to these school board meetings, sometimes I'm wondering, wait, where was this parent why is this parent during public comment? Is this the only time that they've been heard? I think it needs to be going back and forth. I need to be the representative of the San Francisco community to the superintendent and our staff, but also make sure that it goes back and forth and go back to families and say, actually, this is the conversation I had. And honestly, when I ran 2 years ago as well, I was the immediate runner-up, and I didn't think about it when I started running, but transparency comes back again and again and again as this issue that I see connecting so many of the things that I hear from people on the street about. And I think coming back to voters and coming back to school site families and coming back to students and saying, this was the way policy was made. I'm really grateful to Commissioner Norton's blog, and I'd like to do something like that as a first-time candidate. This is the way an idea actually becomes, you know, how a bill becomes a law. I could make a song about it. But I think that when it comes to school board policy, it's even more nebulous. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next, Matt Haney.
That's a great question. I think that the first thing that we should do as decision makers is make sure that we consult the people who are directly impacted by the decision. So if we're talking about a policy around African-American students, we need to go out and talk to African-American students. If we're talking about the impact of homelessness on some of our students and our communities, we need to go out and talk to those students. So that's the approach that I've taken first and foremost. I set as a goal when I started on the board to go out and visit all of our schools. I've been to all of our K-12 schools, many of them multiple times. I think it's important that our school board members are present, that they're accessible, and that they understand firsthand on a regular basis, on an updated basis, what's really happening in our schools. When there was a policy that impacted School of the Arts, Ruth's Howell School of the Arts, I thought it was very important to first go directly and talk with students here and talk with the community here and to be present and to allow the ideas that I had or assumptions that I had to actually be changed. That's another big part of this, which is that it's one thing to say who you'll consult. It's another thing to say, are you actually willing to be moved? Are you willing to change your own assumptions and actually make them better because of what you're hearing? And I think whether you do that because you're hearing from the people who are being impacted or because what staff are telling you or what teachers are telling you of what this is actually going to look like in the classroom, as a policymaker on the board, you have to be willing to hear that and do something about it. And I think that's a huge difference. Often, some folks mention listening to our colleagues, often I'll be asked before we go into a school board meeting, How are you going to vote on this? Either by a staff member or a community member. And I'll tell them, I don't know yet. I'm actually going to go in and I want to hear what people have to say. I want to listen to my colleagues. I have my questions and I have my thoughts on it, but I also want to make it better. And I think we have a board that challenges each other and tries to make things better and is able to build consensus around shared ideas and shared knowledge.
Thank you. Next up, Phil.
I like the little mic drop at the end. what he said? No, I'm kidding. I think first and foremost, it is incredibly important to get as proximal as possible to what the issue is at hand or the topic of discussion or whatever, and that includes engaging with as many stakeholders as possible, very similar to what a lot of people set up here, around making sure that we engage and include parents, students, families, educators in that conversation around what exactly is the root cause. And oftentimes, in my opinion, the issue is rather superficial, and there's a deeper conversation we need to have around like what are our assumptions about how this will impact your particular child or how this will impact communities as a whole. So understanding the issue as intimately as possible, given that you know many of us don't live that or may not live that every single day. And then my second question would be going right to the district and asking what data do we have on this? What have we done? What have we not done? And tell me like historical context of like where this question is coming from. Then I would look to best practices around the country. There are many, many districts that have been doing the same work that we are trying to do. And what has been shown to work and what has been shown not to work? And how is that going to inform our next steps? And then lastly for me, a huge part of this is around ensuring that we're sticking to our mission of serving every single student and being mindful of the fact that like we have a duty and obligation to be equitable in our schools and ensuring that that is the reason why we are a public school district, that we are making sure that every single student in this district can reach his or her potential. And so always making sure that we come back to that in addition to those conversations that we're having with our colleagues and that we're all aligned on exactly what we are doing and why, and then how are we communicating those decisions outward. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Ian.
Hi there. My favorite leader. Hi. My favorite leaders knew how much they did not know. And so for questions like this, it's really less about capability and more about instincts. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about my instincts and the kind of leader I am. My current day job is I'm the chief data officer for the U.S. Department of Commerce. So obviously, I'm going to go straight to the data, show me the numbers, show me the research, question the source, and then really understand where is this issue coming from. I'm going to be, instincts are also to be independent. I will not be beholden to narrow constituencies, the usual suspects, so folks who tend to show up to events like these a little more often than maybe the parents and teachers and kids that are more impacted by it, whether it be a union or a political group. You can trust that my instincts are to be independent. Another instinct is I'm going to seek out the experts, as was mentioned. If I have a financial question and I don't go to Commissioner Wins, that's kind of crazy. Why would you do that? The expertise is right there, right? So that's an obvious instinct and a wasted opportunity for any leader who doesn't take advantage of that resource. I have a couple other styles that I picked up from my 9 years in the Navy. Any military service folks here? Going to pick up? All right, thank you, sir, for your service. You may appreciate this. Trust but verify. You can only expect what you inspect. You can respect administrators and trust them and rely on them, but sometimes you need to hold them accountable and ask some tough questions and get in there and see really what's going on firsthand. And that also relates to understanding the core problem. In the technology field, we have this principle called user experience. If you have this big problem and you come up with a solution from a distant location, you'll never really understand not just the nature of the problem, but how any solution can be effective. You have to be agile, you have to iterate, you have to test, then go right up there. If there's a question with the school and you haven't actually been there, there's no way a good leader can really understand what's happening on the front lines. Those are my instincts as a leader, and I think ultimately is something that can empower a lot of the other members of the board.
Thank you. And last, Stevan.
We kind of beat this question to death, huh? Everyone is. You know, since I've been building Mission Bit, I've had to ask for a lot of help around everything that's required to, you know, build a functioning nonprofit organization. And being comfortable not knowing things and asking for help is something that I definitely look to do as an elected school board member. There are people that have built a long track record of really advocating for issues that I will seek out when making a decision. And, you know, and because of over the course of my time working in education with staff and with policymakers, I built some good working relationships to go in, and I think on day one, be ready to have some trusted relationships with people that I can rely on. An example of asking for help when I was serving the school district was on the Prop H committee. We oversaw, you know, $25 million in education funding. I didn't know initially when I got on where the money actually came from the city. Well, it's a percentage of the general fund that goes to this part, and then this is how it's divided based on the district's equity standards. Like, I had to sit down with a staff member on my own time and get that whole education on how the money actually comes in, where it goes. Parents would call that office, and they would say, well, there's this amount of money, there's this amount of kids. Shouldn't my kid get this amount of money, too? So it's like, you know, it's a lot of things that we have to continue to investigate. I do want to co-sign a lot of what Commissioner Haney talked about in terms of going directly to the people that are affected and having them in mind when you're creating policy. And there are some times when our district administrators get it wrong and we don't listen to teachers and parents the way that we need to. An example of that was when, one example of that was when, oh, should I give the example or should I stop?
You should stop.
Okay.
You'll have 30 seconds at the end of this whole thing. You can keep going then. All right. For a little change of pace, we are going to do a lightning round. I'm going to ask a yes or no question of the entire group of candidates. And if it is a statement that they agree with, they will raise their hand to indicate yes. Now, I know candidates, they all hate yes or no questions because it's always a yes or a no, but maybe. But we're going to make you do yes or no. Raise your hand if the answer is yes, okay? And then we'll go right to the next question after everybody's given a couple seconds. All right, ready? First question, did you attend public school? Are you or have you ever been a parent or guardian of an SFUSD student? Are you or have you ever been a teacher in SFUSD? Do you currently have any aspirations for higher office after your service on the school board? This is an honest yes or no answer. Oh, we got no hands. Oh. We're gonna move on. Should a high school student 16 plus be able to vote in school board elections? I know that was kind of not a super, but no clapping. Should non-citizen parents be given the right to vote in local school board elections? Should SFUSD reevaluate the current student assignment system? Do you support the SFUSD ninth grade math placement policy as it currently exists? As it currently exists. Ninth grade math placement policy as it currently exists. Should high school start times be later, i.e. after 8 a.m.? Should all students applying to Lowell High School be given the same admission test? Okay, all right. Good job, see that was easy, right? That was not so bad. 10 yes or no questions. Y'all did good. There's a little nervousness I saw over there. All right, great. All right, the next section of our panel tonight are questions submitted by the sponsoring organization. And each question will be directed at three candidates, and they will each have 1 minute to respond. I'm going to be spreading these equally out among candidates. So the first question from Parents for Public Schools. Given the current state of funding in California and SFUSD, if we increase teacher compensation, something else will have to be cut. Should we do this anyway? And if so, what priorities should we shift in order to pay for it. I'm going to start with Mark.
Good Lord. I feel like over the last 5 or 6 years, and when I talk to my colleagues at the site level, they feel like the central office and folks that don't work specifically with students, those folks those positions have grown, and we call it bloated. And I think that even if we cut all of those positions, actually, it wouldn't get us to where we need to be in terms of paying teachers and others that work with our kids what they deserve, and so they can actually live in this city. But that's where I would start. We actually need to do much more than that, and that would be ultimately to split roll Prop 13 so we can get some real revenue in here.
Great, thank you. Next to answer that question, Phil?
The reality oftentimes, well, I mean, not oftentimes, is that we just don't get enough per pupil funding in the state of California to be able to adequately fund our schools. And so that, I think, is a foundational agreement that I think most people here can subscribe to. I think we also need to take a look at, if we want to increase teacher pay, which we should, absolutely, we also need to figure out how exactly we're going to go about funding that. I think a huge part of this is thinking about just teacher sustainability overall, and what are we doing to get as much funding as possible at the school level so schools can determine how to retain their teachers in the best way. If that means investing more in professional development, which agreed should happen, then that should be the case. But I do think that I think the repeal of the change in Prop 13, looking at additional funding and how we can streamline efficiency systems at the district level so we can get more dollars to our school districts. Realistically, like fundraising privately for schools is not a sustainable option long term. And I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you. And Jill.
Well, here's what I think. I think that there are things we should look at. I think some of them are symbolic. I do think we should look at a lot of the positions that we've added centrally, including curriculum positions, teachers on special assignment, things like that. But I think, this is what I know, actually. What I think is that we have started a lot of programs in recent years. Increasing teacher compensation and other forms of compensation, not salaries and benefits and supporting housing, is my highest priority for the coming years. And that means mainly we cannot, even though we need to, continue to develop new programs. We are going to have to restrain ourselves, say we must put the money into our staff because they need to be able to live here and they need to have competitive salaries and all forms of compensation. And I think the main place that we're going to go to get money, really, I mean, there are things we could do. There are, besides some positions, we have a disagreement with the teachers union about how we invest in AP time, et cetera, lots of things. But the most important thing is that, finish this sentence. As money increases, which it does every year, naturally, we have to not put it in programs and instead put it in compensation.
Thank you. Next question, San Francisco Parent Pack. Because of the district's decision to not offer the Common Core Algebra 1 course to eighth graders and the limitations set for who may take the math validation exam to place out of Algebra 1 as a ninth grader, parents and students have expressed concerns about the lack of options to ensure that every student in SFUSD will have both the choices and a pathway to be competitive in their application to a high-quality college STEM program if that is their choice. How will you ensure that SFUSD students are not put at a competitive disadvantage to private school students, as well as students from other public school districts who are offering options and pathways to their students to reach high levels of math in high school? Ian, let's start with you.
Well, I love math. I'm an engineer. And I would say that this is probably the dominant issue that I hear from parents, and probably number two or three that I hear from teachers when I'm out talking to folks about where do you think the schools are going, how are they performing. I want to be very clear, I do not support the recent decision made by the current school board in terms of, as I can say, rolling back on eighth grade algebra. How to bring it back, this is tricky now because it's a curricular decision about, well, if you already have a standard, how do you then bring it back in? I think the larger question that needs to come up beyond just this one issue, how would I respond to future issues, is the false choice of choosing between equity and excellence. I don't believe it's a choice between equity and excellence. If you're starving and you're broke as we are, it may feel that way, But I think there's some real opportunities to raise both. We can increase the diversity of our schools, which is the worst it's been in decades. We can provide individualized learning programs. We can provide an opportunity to be the national leader in STEM, but we have to invest in it in the right way.
Thank you. Rob?
We did it before. There's absolutely no reason we can't have our eighth graders take Algebra 1 again. It's not about the Common Core, as some people would say. It's just about a pathway to acceleration and to excellence that once existed, and we should look at what we did before to bring that back. And a lot of parents, this is a number one issue for me as well. I've been hearing from so many people. If you can't take Algebra 1 in the eighth grade like you can in San Mateo County or Oakland or Alameda or San Diego or L.A. or Sacramento, then you're not going to be able to compete with students from around the world. San Francisco is not a bubble. If you can't take the prerequisites for advanced physics in high school, then they can't compete and go to the four-year universities of their choice. It's something that we're going to seriously have to work on, and it's surprising to me that this board has been so intransigent when it comes to parent complaints about this.
Thank you. Trevor.
Well, I think one of the important things is that eighth grade algebra isn't what we're competing with. It's calculus. It's the advanced side. And then being very transparent about how students will get to calculus is a communication problem that has been a serious crisis, again, from what I hear from parents all the time. I believe the question was more specifically about the entrance test. And I think that alone is something we can do. We should be looking at sending teachers on special assignment to middle schools that have a population that's really eager for math. If students want to learn something, you should never say no to them. But I do think that there is something inherently complicated about private school students being able to test into advanced math. I know that the district says that a very small number of students can do it. And you know what? That's fine. But for right now, where we are as a community, this issue might get resolved 5 years down the road when people sort of realize that, oh, okay, there is a pathway to calculus. But right now, let kids take the test. Let them see where they are, and let parents have the confidence that the school district has their back.
Thank you. Next question comes from Second District PTA. Currently, SFUSD does not have in place a universal communications plan to provide real-time interpretation and translation between SFUSD teachers and administrators, parent-teacher associations and organizations, and our non-English-speaking families for parent-teacher conferences, IEP meetings, and assessments. What plan would you implement that will fill this gap and provide a system-wide, easily accessible, multi-language interpretation and translation services to engage all families with their child's education? And Stevan, let's start with you.
Yeah, this is an issue I'm really familiar with because my time at Thurgood Marshall as an academic advisor, I sat in on a lot of parent-teacher conferences, and we couldn't have the meeting if we couldn't get an interpreter. And the district was really short-staffed with interpreters. It was hard to schedule somebody. You have to schedule that person and the parent whose schedule is also impacted because they're working. And we have, 44 documented languages in our district of people, families that are sending their students to our district. So I do think this is something that we can address with technology. Obviously, we need to look to fill our interpretation ranks so we can have people that are qualified and ready to go. But to the extent that we can have tools to facilitate conversations that are for people that are qualified and yet be remote, I think that could be a very viable solution, something that we can do short term. And look to our community of technology partners that are in the city to help solve that issue.
Thank you. Rachel?
So it's a big problem. It's a problem really in allowing us to engage a big segment of our parent community. It's interesting, special education, you have to have an annual meeting every year with your child and the teacher and to decide sort of what the child's plan and goals need to be, and that has to be And there has to be interpretation available so that the parent can fully participate in the IEP team. Now, special ed was talking about a technology solution just like what you're talking about, like getting everybody on Skype, which would allow the existing interpretation staff to be more places than they can be if they're itinerant. So I'm very interested, and actually I'm wondering if we never really invested in that and just talked about it, because I had been under the impression that we were investing in that. But I think, you know, this is, again, the problem. I mean, it's a real need in our district. It's something that parents need, and it's something that requires investment. And if we're going to say that teacher compensation is our top priority, which it is for me as well, our investments have to be imperfect in some of these things. So it's important, but that's an example of exactly the kind of hard choice that you have to make.
Thank you. And finally, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that's been said on this. I think that this is an area that's underfunded. It's become a greater issue lately. We've heard a lot more about it. I think as a board, we have to take this seriously. We can't have a situation where so many of our parents cannot be engaged with school and a full partner with school because of language barrier. And so what I'd like to see is us work with some of the organizations that are here, work with the PTA to help develop that plan, get your ideas, get your thoughts, work collaboratively. We do have funding limitations, but we can also be, I think, smarter about how we do this. This is actually the first I've heard of the idea, I think really great idea that both Stevan and Rachel put forward around technology. And I think that we should have that conversation. So I hope that in this next budget cycle, we can invest more in this area, invest more in translators because we don't have enough, but also do it in a smarter way and use all of the not just technology, but partnerships that are out there to help us solve this problem.
Thank you. Next question. This is from Support for Families of Children with Disabilities. Do you have personal or professional experience working with children and or youth that have disabilities or their families? And if so, what is that experience? And let's start with Ian.
So experience working with children and families with disabilities, did I hear that right?
Yeah, personal or professional experience.
Personal, professional, okay. Mm-hmm. I'll start personal. One of the communities that or organizations that I support in San Francisco is the Blue Bear School of Music. I'm a musician, I was raised by musicians, and it was one of the first ways I got, I guess, civically involved when I first came to San Francisco many years ago. And a lot of what they do is bring music education to those schools and communities that have had their funding cut, some public schools and also other organizations, including families with disabilities. And there's a kind of a powerful overlap between what can happen when you don't just provide the instrument, but provide the community, the teacher, the mentor, the real family connection. And I did that not just as a board member, but also literally in the classroom. And that experience was very powerful for me in many ways. It just drove a lot of my own desire to bring more resources and public-private partnerships to the type of support that this community needs so dearly. So that's the personal story, and I hope to come back to this later.
Thank you. Stevan?
Yes. So in my time at Thurgood Marshall and now my time at Mission Bit, I work with students that have had learning differences. And, you know, it was an incredible learning experience for me to, you know, work with parents to figure out what were the best ways to put their young person in a position to succeed. Also, just want to really commend the deep connection that Rachel does have to this community. Because she knew the students that were in my program and their families, and we had a lot of good conversations about, you know, how they were experiencing the program. What I have learned is that, you know, parents have had to really fight hard to get their kids what they need. It's been an awful experience for a lot of families to constantly run up to the district to try to ask for this and ask for that and ask for this and ask for that, and so. That community is tight, and they are fierce. They are, like, ready to fight for their kids, and I just really want to commend all the hard work they're doing, and I hope to be a supporter of yours if elected.
Matt?
At a personal level, I was for some time a tutor of a student at James Lick Middle School who had an IEP. I think that all of us have had people in our families, cousins and friends, and others who have had the experience of having learning differences in school and experiencing some of the challenges and barriers associated with that. At a professional level, I've learned a lot over the past 4 years about this question. I think as a board, it's something that we take very seriously as a district. We want to ensure that all of our children can fulfill their potential, that we're not excluding children or segregating children in our schools. We've moved, as Rachel said, towards a full inclusion model. And at a professional level, in every school that I've visited, I've spent some time learning about this because it's a huge question and challenge that all of our schools are facing. So I've tried to, in the interest of better educating myself, not just learn about the issue, but understand how it relates to everything that we do and become a champion for these students and their families.
Thank you. And now, San Francisco Education Fund, describe how you view arts education in SFUSD schools across the district. Please give us your viewpoint in providing arts curriculum in our schools, particularly our currently underserved schools, and how to achieve or update and fund arts education goals established in the Arts Education Master Plan. And if you think arts education isn't a curriculum priority, please elaborate on that too. And let's start with Rachel.
So the Arts Education Master Plan is every student, every school, every day. And I believe very deeply in that principle. And I know that some of the concerns around some of the legislation that we've sponsored regarding School of the Arts came from concerns about inequality between what different schools were providing. I mean, one of the things that our data shows is that most of the students who are applying to School of the Arts are coming from a handful of middle schools. So what that tells us is that we have to do, first of all, more outreach to students at other middle schools to make sure that they know what is available up here. But in addition to that, we have to make sure that there is enough offered to students in elementary schools, in early middle school, so that they get the fire lit, so that they can then aspire to come here, because it is a very, very special place, and it's something that I think everyone on the board is very, very proud of. So I'm fully interested in continuing to invest, again, with the caveat I said about priorities and spending. You know, I want to fund everything and I can't fund everything.
Thank you. Phil?
I think arts education is incredibly important and valuable to contributing to a student's holistic education. I think you see this actually when the term STEM has been adjusted to actually include arts, so it's now STEAM. And I think that is a perfect indication of how even parents and communities are wholly responding to the desire to have art infused into the everyday lives of students. I think we need to look into our communities. San Francisco is incredibly diverse and so full of individuals who are so talented in so many different ways. How are we engaging with those organizations to ensure that we are partnering with community organizations to bring San Francisco born and raised artists and musicians and into our schools, I think is one thing. I think this is where we can find wonderful philanthropic opportunities to augment the work that we are doing already in schools to support them financially. And I know that through initiatives such as Spark SF and other opportunities that we've already begun that, but I think we need to deepen those relationships and partnerships to ensure that we're providing consistent funding for schools.
All right, and Mark.
Well, I live this every day at Cleveland Elementary School. Arts are crucial for a well-rounded education for all students. If you come to my school at 9:30 any day, you will see all 365 students and most adults dancing every day in the morning. We get rid of our PE minutes, but we also learn how to dance. We have a professional dance teacher teaching them. And then we have two wonderful VAPA teachers that teach both visual arts and performing arts for our students. However, I have to say, when I was the principal at Horace Mann Middle School for 2 years, not one student of mine got accepted to SOTA. So I know that the school board, when I first got on the school board in 2000, the board was adopting a policy to deal with both the lack of representation of certain students of color at both SOTA and Lowell, but it didn't really result in students getting into SOTA or Lowell in any large amounts that were of color and poor. So I think we can do a lot better.
Thank you. All right, now the final section of the evening will be questions from audience members. If you have any final questions, go ahead and write them down, but I have a whole bunch right here. There's a lot of questions out there. This is wonderful. Two candidates will answer each question, and they will have, again, Carol, 1 minute to respond. I'm going to start with this question. Let's start with you, Jill. I am not an SFUSD parent. I was, but both of my kids are now in private schools. What do you think needs to be done to win back some of the middle-class families? Is SFUSD interested in bringing them back?
We are interested in that. And what I've actually said this to Trevor when he says, you know, parents of young children are just planning to leave the city. So that, and my experience with people who have done that is that they regret it. Is that the public schools in San Francisco, for the most part, and one of the main things that San Francisco schools have that suburban schools do not have are arts programs. Thanks to the Public Education Enrichment Fund, to a huge infrastructure, arts funders, Carol Kosovar, the PTA, and all the work that we've done for many, many years. And people, when they go to the suburbs, they're shocked that suburban schools do not have the programs that we have, and they don't have the resources that the city provides, the city itself, but also that the city and its rich diversity of all kinds of cultural and support institutions provide. So, yes, we're interested in private school students coming back to the middle-class students being in the public schools.
Thank you. Trevor?
This is a big issue for me. The rumor mill needs to be stopped. We need to dispel the notion that there are bad schools out there. And I also think that we need to be honest with the way we solicit feedback. I know we all want to fix the assignment system, but one of the big things I want to do with the assignment system is if you go through the assignment system and you don't enroll, we should send you a SurveyMonkey. We should figure out what that process was like for you actually. I want to move away from anecdotal evidence. Everyone has something they heard about that school. Well, did you hear about that from somebody who looks like you in this line at Andronico's? Did you hear about that from, because there was one report, Stefan can talk about how one story can change the reputation of a school in a dramatic way. And we have to fight that. 30% of our school-age children going to private school is unacceptable. I refuse to live in a city where we are so forward-thinking, yet we go along with business as usual. If it starts with something as easy as PR and a SurveyMonkey, that's great. But I think we need to make that a goal. We need to have that, again, as I said in my introduction, as a long-term goal. I want to build schools in anticipation of having 100% of our school-age children go to public schools.
Thank you. So we do have a massive teacher shortage. This question addresses that to a certain degree. How do you plan to improve funding for special education and to train and or recruit learning specialists? This is an area, special education, significant shortage. Rob.
The special education budget has gone, just in the last 2 years, from $73 million to $90 million. And there's, I think what's not happening is people aren't really looking at why. I think there's just response to the need and throwing money at it. But I think that there's some kind of synergistic environmental toxicity or something that is affecting children that never was before. When I grew up, it was extraordinary. There was the kid over there who had asthma. Now you go in a classroom, there are 7 kids who have asthma. What's going on? I think we really need to look at that. As somebody who works for a Department of Public Health for San Francisco, I have a very strong interest in that. A very strong interest, you know, they talk about the price of EpiPens, but nobody's talking about why we need the EpiPens. So I think we really need to have a strong look at exactly what is happening to the kids that we have to spend this much money on special ed, and then we can bring down the cost.
Thank you. Rachel?
Okay, so it's not the kids' fault. I'm just going to say that right now. And what I think is that, I mean, so first of all, you know, it's not as if right now we don't have differential compensation. So we don't pay special ed teachers differently than we pay other teachers that have a similar level of education. So if you have a master's, you earn more than if you don't have a master's. You do get a little bit of a stipend right now if you are in a hard-to-fill subject area, which special ed definitely is. One proposal that I'm very
interested in is increasing the stipends to these hard-to-fill subject areas, so that instead of $2,000 a year, maybe you could get a stipend of $10,000 a year, because the need is that great, and it needs to be real. I mean, $2,000 doesn't pay my monthly rent, but $10,000 would pay a couple months' rent. So I think that's where we're going to start to be. We have to be competitive, but the larger issue is a state and national issue that not enough people are going into teaching, and the reason why is that we don't pay teachers enough and we don't respect them enough, and so that's a bigger issue.
Thank you. SFUSD wants to build a new school in the Bayview. However, the current school is under-enrolled. How would you make the existing school more enticing? Would you change the school enrollment process, or would you do both? And let's start with you, Mark.
Wow. What we do know is that, and this is really sad to say, but we do know this from analysis of how people make choices about schools in the city, is that the more African-American students that are in a school, the fewer other students' families will choose those schools. And so what we've done over the years is close more and more schools that were predominantly African-American, but when African-American families left the city and there still were African-American students in those schools, nobody else, meaning anybody else in those neighborhoods, whether they were Chinese-American, Latino, or white, would actually enroll in those schools. So this is an issue. It gets really deep about who we are as a community and what we want for our own students, and what, if we do value diversity, what does that look like? Everything else seems to trump diversity. When we interviewed 600 folks in around, I think, 2007, through the PAC and other organizations, we found that everything trumps diversity in the city, whether it's program, safety, test scores, or anything else, diversity is trumped.
Steve Vaughn?
So in terms of the current under-enrollment at Willie Brown, that's the school you're referring to.
I believe so.
We've seen in our city tremendous turnaround stories for schools that have been under-enrolled and haven't had a lot of participation to being now over-enrolled. Balboa High School is one. Mission High School is another. I think that we currently now have a principal at Willie Brown that has a track record of building enrollment. When he was at Burden High School, I just happened to know a lot about this issue. When he was at Burden High School, enrollment went from about 700 to 1,100. He came in and the school was in disarray. He's now stabilized a lot on campus, and he is a champion around recruitment. When he was at Burden, he would go to eighth graders and say, come to my school. There was that type of personal touch and being a champion for the school that really led to the increases in enrollment at Burden. That's also been the reasons why Mission and Balboa have turned around, a combination of grade school leadership, willing partners, and folks that know how to go out into the community to really speak to the value of the school. So give Willie Brown time. It's going to be over and over before you know it, trust me.
Thank you. Statistics show that sexual violence among students in K through 12 is increasing and occurring at younger and younger ages. If elected, how will you prioritize the protection and empowerment of SFUSD student survivors, and how will you work to create an environment in which sexual violence does not exist? To be clear, we all know policies addressing how sexual assault and violence, we all know policies addressing sexual assault and violence exist, but do not always have the intended impact or effects. Let's go with Phil.
I think we must have a conversation with our students and in the community of our schools around what sexual violence is, name it, and ensure that our students have an adult somewhere in the building that they are confident in approaching and discussing this with. That is incredibly, incredibly important, and I think we need to have someone at every single school site who is trained, who knows how to respond and how to build a community of people that are not only recognizing it, but know exactly what to do if there is any sort of indication that something has happened with one of our students. And we as a district then need to make a very clear stand, which I know that we have hadn't done in the past, but make it clear to our families that our schools must be safe spaces for our students. Make it clear to our families, make it clear to our entire school community. And that is time, but
Thank you. Jill.
Well, you're right. We do have the policies in place, and we have, this is, I think, a good example of the right policy work, the plans for implementation, but it's hard to actually implement these kinds of policies and programs with fidelity across a big system. So this is the one and a very, very important opportunity for us to look at the implementation of those programs. So these are the kinds of policies where we're supposed to have a person at each school who is the identified person. It's not a separate staff person, but somebody's assignment to be the one who has the expertise, who goes to the professional development, who brings that to their colleagues, who talks about that. And I think that we have this is not the only area where we really need to be working on not starting new programs, but looking to the full implementation and the quality control and accountability of the programs that we have. So I think this is a good way to do that.
Thank you. Next question is about JROTC. What is your position on central funding of JROTC, which benefits over 1,000 students, many of whom are students of color? Matt?
So I support the current arrangement that we have now, which is that the schools, if they want to fund JROTC and put in their school, I think it does have an important role. And many of our schools are stepping up in doing that. And so I support that current policy. I think we have discussed this year also some other opportunities for JROTC to receive PE credit and to, I think, streamline the credentialing process for the instructors. I think the way that we've done this in the past years has created some barriers and created challenges for the instructors. And frankly, it wasn't working because we had them do something that none of the instructors were doing, which was being required to get a PE credential. So there's a new state law that allows them to get a specific JROTC credential and offer PE credit. That was something that I think we should see if we can do, if they can meet the PE minutes as required under the law. So I support that. I think it does have a role in the district for some students, though I do think it's important that we maintain the current structure of site funding and federal funding, which is where most of the funding should come from because it's a federal program.
Ian?
I'm trying to dissect what you just said, and what I'm not hearing is we're not doing enough to support the program. I recognize that there is a history to this question, and that general consensus has shifted and evolved, and there was a recent compromise and improvement to do more for the program, but it's not actually supporting the program in my mind. And I think it's a particular challenge because of the communities that are really strengthened by this. I'm an ROTC graduate. It doesn't fit for everybody, but as an optional elective, I think it's a fantastic program that particularly helps very specific communities, and it's a disservice to take that away. Let me make just a broader point, though, with the time that remains. I think that there's a lot of lost opportunities in the way we're making choices for our kids. I think that the public schools do too much to close the door to charter schools, close the door to ROTC, close the door to Teach for America. And there are certainly ways to improve these programs, but the way the current leadership has been shutting out these programs, shutting out these communities, I think is a real disservice to the students, to the families, and the teachers.
Thank you. Next question, coming back to art, and specifically Ruth Izawa Soda. Annually, the school needs to raise about $1 million through nonprofit, through the nonprofit, to bridge the gap between what the school needs and what the district provides, mostly coming from parent donations and income from school performances. The district is pursuing a project to move the school and plans to spend over $300 million for the project downtown. Should the board not ensure the school program is totally funded first before spending time, energy, and funds to renovate a building and move? And let's go, Trevor, start with you.
I think that does sound like it makes sense, but the move to downtown, Jill can probably talk about this much better than I can, is an enormous, probably glacial move. I think that it's important to provide schools the autonomy to be in charge of their own programming as much as possible. If you're raising money for your school site, you should be allowed to do what you want with that school site and with that money. And I think that it's important to preserve that. I think the move to the downtown is going to be a good investment for the city, but I am worried about its cost, and I'm also worried what it's going to do to the families at SOTA. and the current programming at SOTA, and honestly, the independence of SOTA. I think that I've heard from families that there's been too much meddling with very specific programs, and I always defer to a decentralized, site-specific viewpoint when it comes to planning.
Great. Rob?
I think moving the Arts Center downtown is a fantastic idea. The location is right next to the new Jazz Center. It's right in the middle of the where the ballet and the opera and the symphony are. I think the population of SOTA is going to benefit tremendously from the closeness to those resources. I think as far as money goes, we're going to obviously have to pull in some private funding for that, which makes sense. I think there needs to be a concerted effort to reach out to create new public-private partnerships and leverage them in such a way that we can afford to build this facility. I think it's a fantastic thing. One of the things that I want to do is bring more music teachers to the elementary schools, which will actually help out and making kids better musicians and making them more likely to go to SOTA in the first place. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's go back to the math question because there's several questions on that. And this is directed at incumbent board members, so I'm going to ask a couple of you. Can incumbent board members please explain simply and explicitly why the math sequence was made policy and how it helps all kids, those who are behind, those at proficiency, and those who are ready for accelerated in math? In other words, how will it improve outcomes for all students? And Matt, let's start with you.
Sure. So certainly that's the intention of this policy. The old approach was not working for that. It was tracking students. We had huge numbers of students once they got to high school that were failing math. Especially for students of color, it was a terrible approach to ensuring that all of our students had the ability to excel at math. Math is changing. It's becoming more in-depth. It's becoming more applied. Common Core math, we believe, is moving in the right direction, and this sequence helps us teach it more effectively. At the eighth grade level, we want to move towards an opportunity where all of our students get a chance to go deeper in math so that they can be successful in high school. I do think, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't raise my hand in terms of where we are now, is I think we need more opportunities for students to accelerate in high school. And that's something that I'm committed to, and our board is committing to exploring those options. We're going to, on November 1st, there's a committee of the whole. I invite you all there, especially those who are interested. We're going to talk about this issue of what options should be available in high school to make this work for everybody.
Jill?
Yeah, but I agree with what Matt said. Well, this is for many, many years, there has been a lot of discussion about that the way we teach math in America is very superficial and not really skill building. It's and artificially separated various supposed math subjects. And so the Common Core math actually does the opposite. It's a much better way to teach math. It's and the skills are integrated. The algebraic skills actually start much, much earlier than eighth grade, but it's not the distinct algebra course, but rather skills are integrated throughout the continuum. And by the way, I think the most important thing, for me at least, and the board seems to have consensus on this, is that looking at the data, so far, it's working. The data that we had about the success of students who were taking eighth grade algebra was that they were not succeeding in the out years. It was not helpful to them. All students, all those students that you described. And now they seem to be doing better, and our scores are really quite impressive. So we're looking carefully, monitoring carefully, and making sure it's the right decision.
Thank you. The next one, I like this question. The structure of the school experience, age-divided classrooms, divided by subject, punctuated by bells and passing periods, and broken into quarters and semesters, is from the early half of last century. What does a 21st century school look like? Or more specifically, give an example of what you think these classrooms the 21st century classrooms should look like. Let's start with Trevor.
So for me, it's about collaboration and creativity. I think those are the two things that are missing from our schools right now. Collaboration, the more that teachers are able to work together, one of the reasons I love my job is I get to teach language arts and social studies in one class. You have more time with students, you get to build those relationships, especially in middle school, it's so valuable. But collaboration is a buzzword, but it's a buzzword for a reason. And creativity is being added to STEM, but it's being added for a reason. It's what we're hearing back from the marketplace, it's what we're hearing back from our own students who are going to even more competitive college world. It's also what we're seeing from around the world. Around the world, what the standout schools are where you see students working together, students designing their own curriculum to a certain extent, and where you have teachers really being able to sort of be let loose. I think the best schools that you see even today in our city are schools where the principal has said to teachers, I trust you, I'm going to support you, because you're in this for the right reasons. You're in this because you care about students, and go forward and make it happen and work with others to get them on board with it.
Thank you. Steve-On?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. 21st century classrooms have to also keep in mind what it means to attract 21st century workers to be in education. The model that we have around the profession of educators is very outdated. We need to make it relevant and exciting for people that are coming out of college or want to change careers. Also believe that we have a school system that's designed to fit a certain type of student, a student that comes from a family that's well-supported, they come to school ready to learn. We have to redesign our schools to better support students that come from different communities. I think collaboration is right. I think creativity is on point. I think that we have to have schools that really understand how to engage the families that they're serving. If we are having schools that are sending mail when we know all the parents at the school are using text messages, that's a poor design decision. We have to have user-based design, I think, around how we are engaging our families and have a curriculum that's relevant for the way that we work in the 21st century.
Thank you. All right, next question. Parents who bus their children know that many schools like Grattan have no bus service. Isn't expanding bus service to more schools necessary to integrate our schools? Rachel?
So I am certainly not against having a strategic busing plan. I don't think that our current busing plan is particularly strategic, or you could argue that there's not enough of it, that it doesn't really support our assignment goals. But I would also say that I think that our assignment goals of both supporting low enrollment in some of our most struggling schools, because of the way that we fund schools, it actually is really important to have a fully enrolled school. And in addition to that, you want to have a diverse school, as socioeconomically and racially diverse as you can get. And there are a lot of schools, particularly four schools in the Bayview, that would be far more diverse and fully enrolled if the students who lived in those neighborhoods went to those schools. And so busing students from there to go other places, we've tried that quite honestly, and it hasn't had great outcomes. And I really do think that we need to encourage families in some of our neighborhoods to stay in their local schools. And I put a proposal out to do that. Some felt it was too punitive and that we really needed to offer some carrots in addition to that. I don't disagree with that. I'm interested in trying that again because I think that is closer to the answer than a expanded busing plan.
Thank you. Mark?
Well, busing appears not to have worked to integrate our schools in any real fashion over time in San Francisco or any major city across the country. When I taught at Edison Elementary School, which is in Noe Valley, the school literally was 50% African American, bused in from the Bayview, and 50% Latino kids who were walking up from the Mission. And the white kids were standing in front of the school in the morning to get the buses to go to Clarendon and other schools. There was not one white kid in that school. So if we're going to do busing, if we're going to revisit busing and expand it, we've got to make sure that it actually integrates classrooms, not the school, the classroom. When you walk in the classroom, you actually see diversity. And right now, You can maybe see that in 3 elementary schools out of 70 elementary schools or K-8s in this district. So I'm not about busing kids just for the fact to get certain kids to one place to another. We have to look at how harmful busing can be as well. I mean, African American students being bused out of the Bayview meant that those parents were very far away from their students, their kids, and couldn't be at the school when they needed to be at the school or when they wanted to be at the school.
Thank you. Well, this is kind of a funky question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I think it's sort of the sausage-making question. Can you describe the process of getting endorsements? Because not everybody gets a whole bunch of endorsements, and I think it's a bit of a grind. But Ian, can you describe the process? The question is for candidates, not incumbents. So that's kind of interesting. But Ian, let's start with you.
Oh, man, how honest do I want to be? the process is an interview. Here's who I am. Here's what I stand for. Will you support me? As a first-time candidate, I really started my campaign. I declared my candidacy, I think, before anybody else, and I really thought it'd be the value of my ideas, the strength of my convictions, the how much I would fight for the kids that would matter. I was talking about policies and detailed budget proposals, and no one cared. No one cared. They made up their mind long before I showed up and said a thing. So it's more about relationships and history, and that's the reality of politics. And the stark truth is that in a down-ballot race, even though Hillary's on page one and we're all on page two, the majority of San Francisco voters do not vote for school board. They should, but they don't. They don't understand the connection. And so endorsements, and I'm really sharing all the details here, endorsements are more about advertising than qualifications, in my opinion. And there's a kind of a metric of success for endorsements or fundraising as how likely are you to win. And by the way, if you look at the history, which is all public data, by the way, of how folks run, if you get more endorsements or more money, you tend to win. But I think that that process needs to be questioned in terms of how well it's serving you all as customers of this system and whether it's defending your real interests.
Phil?
So also as a non-incumbent, I agree. It's fascinating, right? As a person who actually prior to January did very little with local politics, to step in, I also came in as an educator saying, I have classroom experience. Why are you running? I have classroom experience. And I think that it's been fascinating engaging with people. I think also it's very due diligence to say there are some incredible people running our city and doing incredible things. And through this endorsement process, what has been amazing has been meeting those people that are doing the good work. The issue is that the process of running oftentimes or sometimes does not match the people who are currently in the system and the people who are not. And so I think that is a question that we do need to engage with and ask. Why is that? And then are the people who are getting in front of individuals who are doing the endorsements, is it actually representative of the people who are generally wanting to engage meaningfully with the city?
Thank you. Okay, now back to student assignment. I really like that question. That was just kind of...
I want to answer that question.
Oh. All right, I'll allow it.
You got to ask for what you want when you're talking to politicians. I'm proud to have the Chronicle's endorsement and the Examiner's and...
Which I have nothing to do with, FYI.
Trevor and I, we ran in 2014 and ran in 2016. I came in as a candidate, initially that had no political connections. I knew one person that was on the school board. I knew Matt. And the experience the first time was, people in politics, they're making political calculated decisions. The way that organizations endorse is not the same the way that elected officials endorse. But people ultimately want to see that you're serious about the race and that you're going to be, committed to doing the work of actually running a successful organization or political campaign, like your organization, political campaign. So no one owes you anything. I think that's one thing that you realize initially, even though I had deep commitments to this district, even though I'm the first graduate of Thurgood Marshall to ever run for office, no one cares about that unless they know that you can actually compete. Now, the people that do make endorsements that I think that are informed and smart tend to be some of the more political organizations. So if you're looking for people to endorse or organizations that endorse, anyone that's endorsed me, you should trust. And okay, I'll
you're good. All right, let's talk about the student assignment system. The lottery system has been nothing short of a nightmare for families entering kindergarten, and most families I know moved out because of this system. It's taken an inordinate amount of time to deal with. How will you make this system work for families? And that's underlined in red. Will the lotto system finally be abolished by you? And Rob, let's start with you.
I've been endorsed by the San Francisco Bernie-crats and the Chinese American Democratic Club. My family has been through this process many times, and we haven't always gotten the schools that we wanted. And we're pretty savvy people. My wife is a teacher. I work for the government. I know how things work. But it's been, for people who aren't as savvy, it's got to be kind of a nightmare. And I think a lot of people end up settling for schools that they may not know how to advocate beyond what they're given. So I think the assignment system could definitely be made more user-friendly for everybody, and we should reach out to a lot of people who don't have, you know, the idea of how to do that. There needs to be more outreach to them. Given that, I think a lot of people prefer neighborhood schools, but there should always be an element of choice, as far as I'm concerned, until there's uniformity of offerings in all the schools, which will probably never happen.
Thank you. Mark?
Well, we have the system because it's basically, over the last 30 or 40 years, we've layered upon layered upon layered policy to try to achieve diversity. That's what it's all about, was to, first through a court order, a federal court order, a consent decree. And ironically, the court okayed the fact that what I just said earlier about 50% of the kids at Edison being African-American and 50% being Latino. The court was okay with that. It was some sort of diversity. So I would agree with a program, and I don't know if there is a program out there, with such a racially and ethnically segregated city that we have, that will actually achieve any modicum of real diversity in the classroom. I don't actually believe that that's what we want as a city. We certainly don't have it in our housing and where we work. So we might want to just try to make the schools that are the hardest to serve schools, the best schools, so that it will attract other students to those schools. It's a hard one.
Thank you. We're at the end of our time. We got pretty even on the number of questions answered by each one. I'd like to ask one more question and have you each just go down the line very quickly, because I think it's an important question. But really, like, 5 seconds. I know that's going to be really hard. Do you think language pathways are contributing to racial isolation at elementary school sites? Stevan, start with you. I know it's a complicated question, but if you could just answer it very quickly, and maybe we could have people talk about that at the end. And go.
It depends on the school site, I would say. At Star King, there are parents that are sending their kids to Chinese immersion. At Bret Hart, we have an immersion program, and that school is already highly segregated. So it just kind of depends.
Rob?
No, I don't believe so at all. My children both went to Alvarado Elementary School, and there was such a diversity of the student body who are in the Spanish immersion program.
Yes, in some cases they are, but they also can have the opposite effect. There are very few Spanish language programs on the west side of the city, for example. So I think we need to think about where we place programs when we're thinking about how to diversify schools.
Ian?
I grew up in a bilingual household. My mother's an immigrant from Costa Rica. My experience was different than my sister's. Customization is key, and we're not doing enough to customize for our kids.
I also think it depends. We need to make sure as a district that we're making sure that access to those programs is equitable, and that is first and foremost in order for us to say whether or not, I mean, language pathways, access to languages are can be great for students, but we need to make sure that access is there for all students.
Similar to what Commissioner Haney said, in some cases it is, but I think that it raises a really interesting question about diversity, which is language pathways are one of the biggest selling points for our district right now. It's bringing in folks who are not being represented in our schools right now, and that, you know, those are the students that are missing from Mark's old school. So I think that we do need to think about customization, but I think that it is true, but it's not necessarily a negative thing.
Rachel?
I'm less concerned about the racial isolation that's happening in very few of these pathways. I think we do have a problem with language pathways in that it's unsustainable. We've made an unsustainable promise, but I don't know that racial isolation is the first problem that I would try to address with this.
Yeah, I think both biliteracy pathway models and dual immersion models increase racial isolation.
Yes, they definitely increase racial isolation, and they require choice. If we have the language pathways, we must have choice, because that's the only way the kids can fit in the schools. If you're going to choose for some of the schools, you have to be able to choose for all of them. So we're stuck with that, because this is the most important thing about the, and actually would not contribute to desegregation either, given the housing patterns. But if the definition of a neighborhood school pattern is that you have to go to your neighborhood school, that you, in order for the kids to fit in the schools, you would only have that one school to go to. You couldn't go anywhere else, which is why I think we need to have this discussion about what we really want, and we've done that for many years and listened to people as much as we possibly can.
Thank you.
So I think if we want to not have racial isolation, we have to be willing to discuss this.
I want to thank the candidates before we go into their final statements. They were all very quick on that last one, which for politicians is really hard. So well done, candidates. We will end our evening with final statements from each of the candidates. They'll have 30 seconds to lead us with their parting thoughts, and we will go start with Jill and work our way back.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming this evening. Thanks again to the organizing organizations. Very important that we do this. Very important that we engage parents as much as we possibly can and others in the room, including students. So I want to thank you all and say that I'm asking for your support so that I can continue the work that I have done to make sure that our priorities are met. And the top of those for me are getting more money for public schools. We have to do that, and it takes committing ourselves not only to the local work, but to the state and federal work. That's the way that we get money, especially at the state level. So I urge all my colleagues and all candidates to understand that they're going to need to make a commitment to that work if we're going to be successful. Thank you.
Again, thank you all for having us here tonight. I'm really honored to be here with you. We were talking about endorsements earlier. I was a Green before, and I didn't have to go through all of this. The Democratic Party, there's so many clubs, and now I am a Democrat, so it's been an amazing trip. I'm honored to actually get the endorsement of the Teachers Union in San Francisco. I'm an administrator. That doesn't happen. So there is such a divide, believe me. And actually, it's one of the things I want to work on if I do get elected, is to make sure that that divide decreases between admin and our teachers on the ground.
So again, like everybody else, I want to thank you all for coming out. I want to thank you for the questions, which were thoughtful and really substantive, and I'm sure that we weren't able to even scratch the surface of everything you wanted to know, and I actually felt like I didn't get enough questions, Jill, but anyway. I enjoyed the opportunity to talk to you tonight. It has been a privilege to serve on the Board of Education. This has been the most difficult job that I've ever done for the least amount of money. But I really think it's so important, and I hope I have won your support for another term. Thank you.
Thank you for being here tonight. You know, when I think about what I really want to do on the school board, it is to bring a teacher's perspective. It is. I'm the only public school teacher on the ballot, and I think that does matter. Because when you talk about a commitment to art, sure, we're committed to art, but is that actually happening at the school site? Or are you using PEEF funds to put in Wi-Fi? You're committed to IEPs, sure, but are you just putting a kid in the front row, and is that actually what that kid needs? You're committed to fixing the lottery system, but are you committed to making sure that our second round isn't done on paper during working hours? You know, there's a lot of aspiration and reality, and I want to be the candidate that ultimately is about where the rubber hits the road and how policies get implemented, and I would really appreciate your support. Thank you so much.
Thank you as well for having us here today. In my opinion, I think as a district, our our two primary jobs is to decrease the barriers of access for teachers, for families, for students with our district, and then secondly, just increase the number of quality schools in San Francisco. We just simply don't have enough. And from what I can contribute, in my opinion, is my background and experience in personalized learning and innovation and new school models and new school classroom models, and really understanding how we can best teach our students and how can we increase the quality of our teaching and learning within our classrooms and schools. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to, with a live mic, to talk about the issues facing San Francisco's education. I hope you can give me the opportunity to really deliver on all of these fantastic ideas. I believe San Francisco has the potential to have the best public schools in the country. There it is. But I think that actual potential has not been met, and it's time for a real change. I actually am proud to have a number of endorsements from a number of leading change makers. I encourage you to check it out at iankalin.com. You can see the details on my budget proposals and see how we can fight more effectively for every kid in San Francisco.
Thank you all again for being here. I also wanted to shout out, there were two of other school board colleagues who are here, Commissioner Morase there in the back there, and Vice President Walton was also here, and our Deputy Superintendent, Guadalupe Guerrero, is here. We have really incredible leadership in our school district and on our school board. It's been an honor to serve over the last 4 years, and to tell you the truth, more than anything, it's been a learning experience. There's a lot more that we can do. There's a lot more that we will do, and I hope that we can partner with all of you, and I hope that I personally have the experience to continue serving and work on behalf of all of our children in San Francisco. Thank you.
I haven't even gotten to talk about my idea for the all-organic cafeteria, but check out my cards. This is my pledge to you. I pledge allegiance to the families of the Unified School District of San Francisco, and to the public schools which they demand, one city studying hard, irrepressible, with equity and excellence for all. And I just want to say thank you. I am running for the families in this district. I feel your pain as only another parent can. And as commissioner, I will be your voice. With me on the board, you will not be ignored. Thank you for your vote.
Personally, this has been an incredible life journey for me. I started my life in public housing. My home was broken by drugs and alcohol. My grandparents raised me from the age of 10. And in partnership with teachers of this city, I'm in front of you. Everything I am, I owe to the school district. Everything I am, I owe to the people of San Francisco. And it has really come a time in my own life, my own professional life, working as a partner to the schools to transition into now a policy level, to serve the same educators and families that are really responsible for all the success and achievement that I've had in my life. So thank you for voting for me in 2014. Word of mouth really matters in this election, and I hope that you'll join the Chronicle in voting for me, if they had a vote, this November. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I want to thank our co-host tonight. I definitely want to thank our timekeepers. I don't know if you know how hard that is. They did a phenomenal job. And most of all, thank you to our candidates for being here, for running, for sharing their priorities and their time. And I want to say good luck to everyone. And for all of you out there, please make sure your voice is heard. Please, please, please vote.